Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and a very warm welcome to Radio Islam International. You are listening to Productive Muslima with me, Suraya Chauhan. So today I'm really excited about the program because I've been waiting to interview our guest speaker, Zaida Mohammadi. She's a life coach and she also is a specialist in body talk. So here's a question for everyone. Have you ever thought about what your purpose in life is? Now, this is something that's, I think at some point, everyone questions their purpose. So as Muslims, we all have a common purpose or common goal, and that is Jannah, inshallah. And that is a common goal for everyone in the sense that it's a belief and it's where we want to ultimately be. But in order to attain this, we have to know certain things. So Allah has given each of us unique characteristics or unique traits within ourselves. And this is why we have to understand what we're good at and make the most of what Allah, use it to the best of our ability so that we can ultimately attain Jannatul Firdaus. So these are the things that we need to deal with, is that we all have different traits, different positive, strengths and weaknesses. And once we realize this, we can go ahead and we can find the best that we can be. And we eventually can actually offer the best in society. We can do the best within the little capacity that we have. So if I find that there's a certain strength that I have, I'm supposed to be using it. It's an amana, I'm supposed to be using it in the correct way. But how is it that we do find our purpose in life? And this is where Zaida Mohammadi comes in. She is going to explain to us exactly how we use our abilities and how we find them in the first place so that we can live the best life that we were meant to live. So let's welcome our guest speaker, Zaida Mohammadi. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to Radio Islam International.
Wa alaikum salam, Suraya. Thank you so much for having me on. It's lovely to be on.
So Zaida, I was just speaking to the listeners and I was explaining how I couldn't wait to speak to you because these are topics that I really, really can relate to. I love the whole concept of finding our inner selves and basically doing the best that we can do and also living through, taking the best out of trials. I find it very inspirational when someone has been through something and they come out finding this beauty within themselves. I just find it utterly amazing. So I've read your work, I've seen your things on your posts on Instagram, and the deep, you know, the way you look at it is so deep. I absolutely love it. So I can't wait to ask you, right? How does a person find what they're good at or what they were meant to be doing?
Okay, well, I'm so glad that's supposed to inspire, alhamdulillah, that is their purpose. And I fully, fully believe in all of it because I have walked that path. So you say, how is it that people, how is it that someone finds their purpose? And, you know, it's like a very big idea because a lot of us, we feel like it's this big thing outside of ourselves, like we should be doing some huge work out there. And maybe that is destined for us. But finding our purpose is really a journey. It's not something, you know, we leave school, we're 17, 18, we hardly know anything about ourselves, let alone the rest of the world, and we're expected to choose a vocation or a career path when we really have no, you know, there's very few of us who can actually say, okay, we want to do this, and then we stick with it for the rest of our lives, and we're happy and fulfilled by it. So a purpose is really a journey. It's an unfolding journey, and there will be different purposes that you serve in different areas of your life. The first thing is to really start to let go of your fear and deal with your worthiness issues as well. And the first way that you can do it, get clear on your why. Why do you want to do something? Because I find, even in my practice, I find so many clients, you know, they've gone down a path, they think it's what they want, but when they really sort of, and then they've lost motivation along the way, and they think it's because they're lazy or they're procrastinating, but what I find in working with them is that they chose the intention with which they chose that specific path. They chose that the thing that they want to do was often chosen from a perspective of not really getting in touch with what they want and what they need. It's about other people. So often we choose our life path, our vocation, and so on based on other people's perception of success. Now, success is a very, very personal thing. What success means for you is not the same thing as what success means for me.
Yes.
So it's about self-awareness and getting honest with yourself and letting go of some of the fear and other people's perception. I think that's the first step there.
You say, yes, it's generally our goals. I think that is so true because generally we do make out these goals based on what people tell us. And sometimes it's also not just on what people tell us. It's what is going to fit into society. Am I right?
Yes. Yes, 100%, definitely. Especially, I think, as women as well, but even as men. I mean, I can't tell you how many people I see where, their life plans are already laid out for them. Even the men as well. You know, you're either a CA or you're a doctor, and anything outside of that is not accepted.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's really about first looking at what's important to you. So, I would say the number one thing, defining your purpose, because it seems like this big, unattainable thing for most people, the number one thing is self-awareness, and a lot of honesty is needed in that, in finding out who you are, what are your strengths, what are your weaknesses, and that will help you to find your purpose.
Okay, that's interesting. So, I guess this is now, you just have to be true to yourself and answer questions. Is that the way to go about it?
That is one way. Look, if you've been lucky enough to, explore your strengths and weaknesses by the time you are 18, 19, 20, then alhamdulillah, that's really good. But for most of us, you kind of find your feet along the way. And what I found often in my practice as well is that it's very often the trials and tribulations that people have been through, the difficulties that they've been through in life that have allowed them to explore the potential of who they really are. And
yes,
through these processes and getting through these situations, they actually find that their inherent strengths start to come to the surface. And self-awareness comes a lot of times, unfortunately, through pain and struggle. It doesn't have to, but it does sometimes. So I'm not sure, with your listenership, how old they are and so on, but I think there's very few of us who get to our 30s and 40s and so on and haven't experienced some kind of trial and tribulation. So working your way through those trials and tribulation in a constructive way, which I think we're going to be discussing later, will help you through that process as well.
Okay, that's really interesting because I think most of us can relate to that. We have, as you say, we have at some point in our lives been through something. Maybe it's not as drastic as the next person, or it may differ from person to person, but definitely something happens and it makes you stronger, wiser. But then, Zaida, what about the person that, say, hasn't went through a struggle necessarily, then they go through life, because when I thought about this topic, I spoke to someone and she said, you have to maybe ask your guest speaker this: what about me who lives through life and I'm happy, I am content, but I've always waited to find that bigger, like someone has this major breakthrough, and she wanted to know now, am I living the life I was meant to be, or is there something else that's supposed to be happening? It's like you're waiting for something to happen, but it's not happening.
Well, definitely, I think, actually, you touched on a very important topic. In my office here, I have a quote from Rumi. It's actually a little drawing, and there's a quote from Rumi saying, the wound is the place where the light enters you. And one of my clients actually stopped one day and asked me a very similar question to you. She asked, well, does that mean that we have to suffer in order to, become
yes.
more wise and all of that?
Yes.
And I said, you know what? I don't think we have to suffer. I don't think we have to have pain. Allah knows best, but I think there's some amount of pain, and it's also our perception of pain. This person you're speaking about is quite happy in their life. They haven't had any major things. The fact of the matter is they've probably had some kind of challenges, some kind of issues. All of us receive some kind of messages through in our life. We receive some kind of difficulty.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's, like you said, maybe it's not as major as the next person. The person who you're talking about, maybe she had a lesser kind of issues in her life, but issues nonetheless. And I've also found sometimes, are we aware of what's going on around us? Sometimes people kind of resist the messages, they resist the lessons that are coming their way. They kind of hide things in a corner and suppress it and, don't look at it. And as life goes on, those kind of things start to come through more and more. And if you look at it with courage and without fear and go through it in a way that's constructive for you, then you can get the gifts that that has for you. But to answer your question, you know, I don't think you have to have pain. I don't think you have to have struggle. Some people can find that. I do know of people who are very happy and actually are living their purpose. They haven't gone through any you know, major struggle in their life. However, for a lot of people who are going through struggle, I see people every day who feel very broken in their life, who feel like they've been damaged through the difficulties that they've been through. This is also a way of just reassuring them that, you know, your struggles are not in vain. There is a way to use it in a positive manner.
Yes, definitely. So, what about the person that may have like stress and anxiety? Because I meet a lot of people that say they have anxiety. They're not unhappy necessarily. They go through life happy most of the time. I actually have a friend that has anxiety. Certain things just trigger it, and she doesn't know why, but she feels anxious. She's not unhappy. She's quite happy with life. But then how do you get to the point where you have peace within yourself and avoid this stress and anxiety?
Okay, so excellent question, because anxiety and fear and stress is something that I deal with on a day-to-day level. I think it's one of the biggest things that people struggle with, and it's also something that people are scared to talk about as well. There's a lot of shame around it, around discussing it. You know, we're supposed to be happy all the time, and if we say how we're feeling, then we're making nashukri, we're not being grateful, and so on. So people don't even want to talk about it. So sometimes people put on a mask and pretend to be okay when they're not, and then eventually one day they break down, everyone turns around and says, oh, well, they seem to be doing absolutely fine. I don't know what happened.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a gradual kind of breakdown that happens. I find anxiety and stress, there is a slight difference between the two. They both have a common kind of underlying issue, but they're a little bit different. Anxiety comes from a lot of fear, and I find a lot of that fear comes from fear of what could go wrong, you know, uncertainty, fear that what I have right now might disappear, and so on. So there's a lot of different ways that we deal with pain from the with fear, with anxiety, sorry, from in my practice. But I find that the fastest way, the easiest way that you can get yourself out of anxiety is to focus on gratitude. Because if you think about anxiety, it's a feeling, right? It's just uneasy, uncomfortable feeling. And every feeling has to be preceded by a thought. So usually the thoughts that are around anxiety are a lot of fear-based thoughts. A lot of thoughts, you know, I'm so afraid of what might happen, what I did wrong, what I might do wrong, what might go wrong, and so on. The fastest way is to focus on what brings you gratitude. Even if it's something simple, think about, I'm so grateful that the sun is shining today, or I'm so grateful that, you know, for my children, or whatever it may be. Focus on gratitude, because that will immediately bring you out of that. And then stress is also a very interesting one, because stress, Surya, is not created in the environment. Stress is not because of circumstances, it's not because of people or situations. Stress is created in the mind. And very often it's not the situation that's causing us stress, but our thoughts around it and the meaning or the interpretation that we give to the situation. So a simple example I can give you is somebody gets stuck in traffic. And, you know, you have two people stuck in traffic. And sometimes you see them, even there's a traffic jam, and one is sitting there listening to the radio, relaxing, taking it easy, going as fast as they can possibly go. Embracing the situation. And the other person is just, you know, losing it completely. You know, they look like it's really not going to work out for them. Both of them might have equally important appointments to get to. They might have equally important tasks to fulfill that day. But you'll find that the person who's stressing out has, they're already in a negative thought spiral. They're already thinking, okay, so I'm going to be late for this, then I'm going to be late for that, and that person's going to be angry for me, and that's going to happen. Whereas the person who's calmer has a lot less stressful thoughts around the situation. They've surrendered to the experience. They think, okay, whatever will be, will be. And we're so lucky as believers, we have this understanding that everything that happens, there's khair in it.
Yes.
So sometimes you think that you need to be at a certain place at a certain time, but Allah knows best.
Mm-hmm.
So you can imagine the person who's formed all these stressful thoughts around you, because it's the thoughts that's stressing him out.
Definitely.
Both of them will go through the rest of their days. Both of them will be delayed. Both of them will have challenges because they were caught in the traffic jam. But the one who got himself stressed out with all his thoughts, his entire day will probably spiral out of control. Whereas the other one, you'll find that he'll have a bit of issues here and there, but he'll regain his balance quite quickly.
Because of obviously his thought process.
Yes, his thoughts. So your thoughts are what precede your emotions. So when you are having emotions of stress and anxiety, be aware. Ask yourself. The first thing is, number one, have awareness. What am I thinking about? What are the thoughts that I'm having that are contributing to this feeling? Are these thoughts empowering or are they disempowering? Mm-hmm. If they are disempowering thoughts, how can I change them to more empowering thoughts? Mm-hmm. And the fastest way to change it to an empowering thought is to focus on gratitude. What can I be grateful for? So the person was stuck in a traffic jam. Okay, I'm so grateful that I'm safe. I'm so grateful that I have a car. I'm so grateful that I'm late for my job. I'm so grateful that I have a job. You know? Mm-hmm. Alhamdulillah. So notice your thoughts around it, because your thoughts create your stress.
And obviously this will now differ from individual to individual, because I guess some people do look at life as a cup half full and some as empty, you know. So you're looking at the same cup but in different ways. So I think that has to come from yourself.
Definitely. And it's a choice that we make. You know, some people say, I'm just an optimist or I'm just a pessimist. It's a choice that we made somewhere along the line to say we're an optimist or pessimist. In any given moment, you can choose to see the good in it. And if you trip yourself up, I think this is important for the listeners to hear as well. Mm-hmm. If you trip up and if you find yourself in a negative thought spiral, it's okay. You can get yourself out. All it takes is one positive thought to turn things around. Just be aware and monitor your thoughts.
Now, don't you think, okay, I'm just throwing this curveball here, but don't you think some people would say, are you building castles in the air?
You're building castles in the air. Yeah, they probably will say that. They're probably the very unhappy people.
No, because I get that, you know, a lot of times. Everything for me is great, wonderful. Yeah. I look at things as... you know, even if it's the sky, it's like your subhanAllah, just look at that, you know.
Yes.
And people tend to think, even in a difficult situation, I just find a different, I look at it differently.
Yeah.
But then I have people who say, you know what, you unrealistic, you're building castles in the air, or I get those comments. So what would you say about that?
I love this question so much, because you're so right, because I know exactly what you're talking about. So if, you know, I'd like to share with the listeners a little bit of insight into neuroscience. So neuroscience is the study of how the brain, how the mind works.
Mm-hmm.
And when you start to understand this, you start to understand that we think we're seeing reality, but we're only seeing a version of reality, okay? How our thought process works is that when we receive some kind of stimulus from the environment, whether it's something that we see, something that we hear, something that we're experiencing in any way, our brain takes this, our mind takes this in. First, it passes through our subconscious mind. But before it can get to our conscious mind and we can be aware of it, and we can make meaning out of it, it has to pass through what we call the filters of our subconscious mind. Now, all of us have filters in our subconscious mind. They're composed of our ideas, our value systems, our belief systems, our perceptions, and our past experiences, and so on. So it's been filtered through. So at any given moment, scientists will tell you your subconscious mind is taking in 400 billion bits of information, okay?
Mm-hmm.
That's a huge amount of information. Now, the fact of the matter is, if that amount of information was passed onto your conscious mind, it would be system overload, right? You'd crash.
Mm.
Also, you don't need that amount of information. Obviously, when you're engaged in a particular task, you just need the information pertinent to that task. So it's also done, as a survival thing, but it's also done to help us out. Now, once it passes through our filters, Surya, can you guess how much information actually gets to our conscious mind? Any ideas?
Half of this.
Less than 1%.
Oh my goodness.
2,000 bits of information are passed through the conscious mind. So that's a huge amount of editing. That's huge volumes of information that is just lost. And there's a very specific process that happens. It's called deletion, distortion, and generalization.
Okay.
And as that information passes through our filters, it goes through this process and then goes to our conscious mind. Less than 1% comes through. So Surya, the fact of the matter is, you and I can be watching the same scenario playing out.
Right.
The 1% that gets to my mind, the 2,000 bits that I receive in my mind will be different to your 2,000 bits. Maybe it will be very different. And then you and I will start arguing that my 2,000 bits is right, and you will argue that your 2,000 bits is right. We're both kind of wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, we're a version of right. So I always use this analogy that we're not seeing the world as it is. We're seeing it through our forces of perception. I'm sure only Allah Ta'ala sees it in the full, you know, in its full splendor.
Definitely.
But we're seeing versions of it. Our human minds can only comprehend a portion. So I always use an analogy of, think of like this giant puzzle piece, right? This huge, or this huge picture. And, you know, you've got in one corner, you've got a waterfall, and then you've got a house, and maybe you've got a mountain, and another area, you've got people making a fire, and then you've got a stream or a river, and then you've got some animals. And each of us is standing on one specific area of that picture.
Yeah.
And all I can see is the waterfall. And so there, all you can see is the lion. Mm. And you're insisting with me that there's only a lion here, and I'm insisting with you there's only a waterfall. It's all about our perception. So we can choose, everything is out there. We can choose our focus. We can either choose to focus on all the bad and all the negative, or we can choose to focus on the stuff that brings us more joy. It's really a choice. So those people who say that you're building castles in the air, well, they're also building castles. Their castles are just not that nice to look at.
Okay, that's very interesting. I actually love that.
In our minds, very much so.
Yeah, so it is perception. And obviously, I personally would think that if my perception is generally positive, then wouldn't that be better for me?
Definitely, 100%. Because what you choose to focus on, the subconscious mind is very intelligent. It's very intelligent in its own way. It's very helpful. Wherever you choose to focus, your subconscious mind will draw in more information like that. So, have you ever had an instance where you have a function where you needed a specific color shoe or specific color outfit? Have you ever had that situation?
Many times.
Right? I think we all as women can relate to it. So, just say for example, you need a pair of red shoes. Now, red shoes are not that easy to find, but you need a pair of red shoes for specific function that's coming up, and you're thinking, okay, I need red shoes. Now you've got red shoes at the top of your mind. You keep thinking red shoes, red shoes, and suddenly you start noticing red shoes everywhere. You notice your friend has a very nice red shoe. When you go to the mall, there's a red shoe there, but it's not quite what you want. And everywhere you go, you just seem to be seeing red shoes all the time.
Yes.
Does it mean that there's suddenly more red shoes in the environment?
No, it means my perception now, I'm consciously now looking at it that way.
Yes, so that's the power of our focus.
Wow.
Whenever we always have top of mind, we'll choose to find more of that in the environment. So if we're always having fear-based thoughts at the top of our mind, if we're always worrying, if we're always looking at the, you know, the darker side of life,
that's all we'll see.
That's all you will see.
Yes.
If you keep on focusing on the positive, on thoughts of gratitude, then you will see that in shower.
Yes, and then you'll obviously attract more of that, I would believe.
100%, yeah.
Wow, very interesting. Okay, Zaida, we're just going to go for a quick ad break. Please stay online with us. To the listeners, if you would like to know anything or you would like to speak to our guest speaker, please call us on 011-854-1548 after the break. Stay with us. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome back to Productive Muslima with myself, Suraya Chauhan. We're chatting to our guest speaker, Zaida Mohammadi, life coach and body talk practitioner, a very, very interesting and inspiring speaker. For those of you who have any input or questions, you can call us on 011-854-1548. So Zaida, before the break, we spoke about anxiety and stress, and obviously the looking at life positively or negatively is unique to each individual. Now, going back, I just want to backtrack to the stress aspect. What if you say that the stress, fear is what triggers off anxiety, right? What is it then that causes that fear?
Okay, so I find very often it's different types of fear. It really depends on the individual, and this is something I explore a lot with my clients. So it depends on the person. You have to get to grips of it. So if you're doing this process on your own, I would ask myself, what I would do is, if I can feel a little anxiety coming over me, I would ask myself, okay, what am I feeling afraid of right now? The answer might not come immediately, but as you do this more, it will come more easily. So just think about what is it right now that's making me most fearful, and explore that. So it's really something on a case-by-case, it's a case-by-case situation that you need to work on. It's not really a one-size-fits-all approach I found in my practice.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's basically anxiety, and you said stress was different, right? That you have some sort of control over?
Well, anxiety I think you also have a control over, but remember I was talking about the subconscious mind, and the subconscious mind, a lot of times the anxiety that we feel are coming from that subconscious mind. So stress is a little easier to target. Whereas anxiety sometimes, look, sometimes you can get to the root of it. I find it's often anxiety around a big one. I found anxiety really strikes a lot for people who live from perfectionism. People who, you know, are real perfectionists. And perfectionism is a very, very big thing for women as well in our society. Perfectionism is basically a situation, I'm not talking about perfectionism from, you know, some people confuse it. They think, okay, well, if you're saying don't be a perfectionist, you're saying don't strive for excellence, don't try to progress. That's not what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. Healthy striving for progress, healthy striving for excellence is really good, and we are asked to do that in our deen as well. I'm talking about perfectionism that comes from a place of fear of not being enough. So you feel like I need to constantly do more so that I can prove that I'm enough. I can prove it to myself and I can prove it to other people. So I find a lot of anxiety comes from the fear of not being good enough, the fear that other people will, you know, realize that I'm not as good as they think I am. I'm not worthy enough and so on. So it also comes down to, you know, the way you feel about yourself, self-concept as well. And I find very often with working with clients, we don't work directly with the anxiety. We work with their worthiness issues and their self-acceptance issues, automatically the anxiety starts to reduce itself.
Okay. Zaira, with regards to difficulty, and this is a common question, how do, like someone who has been through grief, who yes. has lost either a child or a member yeah. of a family or something, how do these people channel grief in the correct way, a way that's going to heal them and transform them?
Okay, excellent question. I think grief is something that we're all so afraid of and we want to run away from it.
Mm-hmm.
But even from the perspective of our deen, grief can offer us a real gift.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a quote that I heard that says, dark days are part of the natural order and the transformative process.
Mm-hmm.
So if someone in your life has passed away, you know, you've been abandoned, of course it's normal to feel sad. You know, that's part of being human. So I think the first step is to be honest with yourself. The first step of emotional healing is to give yourself permission to feel and to grieve without judgment.
Yes.
Because if you allow grief, then when it ends, it's over. You know, you've seen it through. But if you don't allow it, if you suppress it, that grief is going to keep coming back to you in different ways. Mm. It'll come through conflict, problems, illnesses. And it'll keep coming back until such time as you process it. So in the midst of grief, first and foremost, recognize that this is a painful time, but it will pass. And I always tell clients, be gentle with yourself. You know, sometimes we want to, I think one of the worst things we tell people is, you know, be strong, have sabar, whatever it is.
Mm.
Yes, there's a time and place for that, but initially you have to give yourself allowance. You have to give yourself a space to just be sad and not be okay. I'm going to read you a quote by Dalia Mujahid. She's the sister of Yasmin Mujahid, which
yes.
I'm sure most of the listeners know. And she talks about the example of Hazrat Yunus alayhi salam and his hardship of being in the belly of the whale. So she writes, in your moments of sadness and regret, in your darkest hours, when you are in your own proverbial belly of the whale, it feels like a lonely prison. But could it be that instead of a cell of solitude, it is rather a place of sanctuary? Rather than letting Yunus alayhi salam drown, Allah caused the whale to swallow him. That place of darkness was a rescue from certain death in the raging ocean. Is your hardship a prison or a rescue? Is your regret a punishment or a purification? Your time in the belly of the whale may be Allah's rescue from the raging waves of life's distractions. Perhaps your darkest hour is your space for repentance, so you can be delivered safely to shore. So when we surrender to the process of emotional healing, when we give allowance to the situation, to be reinterpreted in our psyche.
Mm-hmm.
So in grief, we can grieve with a peace, not with a closed heart. And, you know, so this, only if we engage ourselves with this process can we move forward to a better place, to an evolved version of ourselves with a more open heart that's capable of compassion and empathy. We have more mercy and sensitivity towards the pain of others, and only if we work through this process will we be able to truly trust and surrender to the plans of our Creator.
Yeah, so again, the grief obviously is a moment, it's a time for you to deeply introspect and go through the motion. So I guess the main thing is not to push away that grief, because if you bottle it up, yeah, it does come out later on and maybe even uglier.
Definitely, 100%. I had a client that I was working with. I started working with her in her illness period.
Mm-hmm.
And she was really struggling. You know, she's a young mother, she had young children, and she'd lost her husband quite tragically. And obviously, she was in a deep sense of grief, and she would have really bad days. You know, she would have very, very dark days. Even though she was reading her Quran and she was doing her tilawat, and she understood that, you know, it was part of the bigger process of life, and it was in taqdeer, it was hard. It was very difficult for her. And so through that iddat period, and I think, you know, that iddat period maybe is a mercy unto us sometimes as well.
Yes.
It's really a time of reflection for us and healing of us. So that's why we get all that time, you know. So rather than just saying, be strong, it's a way of working through that.
Yes.
And she worked through her process. And, you know, she came to me after she finished her iddat period. And she came to me and she said, you know what, I recently went out with my mom. And I went out with my mom for the first time, you know, since my iddat ended. And we went to a shopping center with the kids and things. And my mom looked at me and said, I can't believe it. You're so strong. You know, when I first came out after my, you know, after my iddat, I was absolutely devastated. It was so depressing. And she turned around and she told me, I didn't say this to my mom, but what I was thinking was, it's not that I'm so strong. It's because I've done my inner work. It's because I've done my healing. It's because I've worked through all the emotions. I didn't run away from them. I didn't suppress them. And now I feel so much stronger, alhamdulillah. Does it still hurt for her sometimes? Yes. But she's not in the devastation that she was. And I think this is a very important thing for people to understand, is that it's safe to do your grieving. Running away from it doesn't really help. It, like you said, it catches up with you. So do your grieving and know that Allah is there for you. He's catching you through that process. He's being with you through it. And there is a way through. And once you get through, alhamdulillah, you will see the gifts that will arrive from it.
Yes, definitely. And, you know, you say Allah is with you. Generally, when do we find Allah? And I know even with my students, when we have this conversation, many of them, I think majority of them, say that they found the beauty and the mercy of Allah not when they were in madrasa or listening to something. It was when they hit rock bottom and there was no one else. And that is when you find the beauty of Allah and you find the beauty of grieving on your own. And so maybe this also is a mercy from Allah. You know, this rock bottom, because that's where you find Him.
Definitely. You know, Surya, I just want to mention that that thing about when people tell you, whenever there's any kind of trauma, you know, a lot of our people say, be strong. And I think they have good intentions, but I don't think they understand the nature of grief. And so whenever anyone, I've had a client who came and told me, when her brother passed away, everyone around her told her, be strong. So she said she would just cry in her house every day, and then she'd put on a brave face.
Of being strong.
Of being strong. And eventually it manifested in physical illness for her. So showing any emotion or sadness is perceived as a weakness, a flaw. So in order to maintain this pretense of strength, we block ourselves from feeling and we engage in a very, you know, we block ourselves from feeling and engaging in the grief process. So if you look at the world today, Surya, many people have been prescribed antidepressants for situations where it is normal to be sad. Now, I'm not saying I'm against antidepressants entirely, but sometimes it's normal to be sad. It's okay,
yes.
But we try and suppress it with antidepressants.
You're not feeling.
Not feeling. I mean, death, divorce, trauma, all of this, you know, instead of working through the pain, we have we have made it into a pathology, into something that needs to be suppressed.
It's like we numb ourselves.
Yeah, it's something abnormal. But remember, the psyche, it has an immune system, just like the body has an immune system.
Mm-hmm.
And the immune system of the psyche takes time to heal. So you can expect to be sad for a while. You can expect to be down. And when there's a trauma, you need to understand that time is a very vital thing. But in our fear to feel, modern society has decided, like you said, that it can do better than natural systems. That through avoidance, diversion, and medication, it can override this natural system. And that's part of the problem. Exactly like you said, when we numb ourselves, what happens is the price that we pay is we don't gain emotional resilience. We don't learn the lessons that we were meant to. We don't evolve in our consciousness. And I think the greatest price that we face, Surya, is that we have fear of deeper connection. By numbing ourselves, we become disconnected with our own emotions, our healing process, and this makes it very difficult to truly connect with those around us.
Yes.
And that leaves us feeling even more alone and even more alienated, because now we've disconnected from ourselves, disconnected from our emotions, and then we're incapable of connecting to those around us and those who really might need us there as a support through this process.
I agree 100%, and it's very important what you said, in that when people are grieving, yes, we may say it with good intentions, be strong, and the other one is make sabr, but people don't realize sabr doesn't mean, even Islamically, the word sabr, patience, it doesn't have anything to do with not grieving. Sabr is grieving, because Nabi Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam went through grief, and he cried, when he lost his uncle, he cried when he lost his daughter, his wife. So he exposed this grief to others, and the Sahaba saw him cry. So it has nothing to do with not going through the emotions. And I think people have this misconception that if you make sabr, like when a woman is smiling through her pain, everyone tends to say, wow, she has so much sabr. Mm. That's not sabr at all.
Yes, it's suppression. Yes. And honestly, I think it's the easier route. It's the much easier path. It takes a lot of courage to actually dig deep and allow yourself to feel that kind of pain.
Yes.
A lot of courage.
Yeah. Definitely. And a very important one, and this is something I think everyone's looking for the answer today, and that is, how do you find inner peace? How do you love yourself? And on your Instagram page, you had one I read that said, if you're searching for that one person who will change your life, take a look in the mirror. And I think that is so true. It doesn't get any more real than that. So this is often easier said than done for most people. How do you go about finding this inner peace and loving yourself?
Okay, lovely question, because everything we've focused on today comes back to this, right? If we can love ourselves more, if we can accept ourselves more, then we'll have less stress, we have less anxiety, we'll choose better for ourselves, we'll choose better thoughts for ourselves, because if you love someone, won't you choose the best for them?
Yes.
You'll choose better thoughts, you'll choose better food, you'll choose better relationships, and in that, you'll also allow, you'll feel worthy enough to explore your strengths, you'll feel worthy enough to take the opportunities that come your way, and you'll feel worthy enough to claim your purpose in this world. So everything comes back to this. So how do we, it's such an interesting thing, because we hear about self-love and self-acceptance. So how do we do this? And again, like anything else, it's a process. And it's something that we constantly do for ourselves. So something that I tell clients is, they ask me, like, what is this thing about self-love? Because a lot of people think self-love is about being boastful, it's about being arrogant, it's about thinking I'm better than you. And it's not that at all. That is an inflated ego that's just pretending to be self-love.
Mm-hmm.
And the example that I always give, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners at this time have kids of their own, right?
Mm-hmm.
But those who haven't, say, Allah grant them good children, but they have kids. Or think about somebody who's close to you, maybe a niece or nephew. It's easy to identify with children. And think about your child, and think about the love that you have for that child. That love goes extremely deep and very, very strong. So the question I often ask is, if your child does something wrong, and who doesn't have a child who does something wrong at something, do you stop loving the child?
No.
No. Is there, and I ask people, is there anything, look, there'll be times where your child does something, Allah always guide our children to good choices and goodness, but there may be times where our children do something that disappoints us immensely, more so because we're disappointed that they've limited themselves in that way, they've made things difficult for themselves, so we're deeply disappointed, we're deeply hurt by their actions or their choices. Does that mean that our love for them stops?
No way. It's the action we hate, not them.
Exactly. At the same time, even though we love our children so deeply, we're constantly teaching them, we're constantly guiding them, we're constantly, helping them out, helping them to strive towards progress. Just because they're not where they should be, does that mean we stop loving them or we love them less?
No, definitely not. We guide them.
This exactly, this is what you have for your children, to have it for yourself.
Wow, yes. Actually, I didn't think of it that way.
You have it for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So loving yourself even when you mess up. Loving yourself even doesn't mean you won't make amends. You can stop and you can say, I messed up and I need to do better and I need to change the way that I'm doing things.
Yeah.
But doing it from a place of love. Loving yourself regardless. So that is really what, if I can sum it up, this is my understanding of self-love and self-acceptance, is that you love yourself for all of you, for all of your shortcomings. You don't wait. You don't wait until, and when I get to this place, when I achieve this, when I'm this weight, when I look like this, then I love myself. No. Love yourself regardless. You have to love yourself where you are right now, with all the shortcomings, with all the flaws, because you will never get to a place where you can say, okay, now I'm ready. That's not going to happen.
Mm-hmm. I guess we're too hard on ourselves.
We are. And the thing about self-love is it offers us so much. When we love ourselves more deeply, we can offer more to the people around us. We can serve better. People who love themselves are more content, they're more peaceful, they have less anxiety, they have less stress, and because of that, they can be more productive. They can offer more of themselves to other people. They can connect more deeply to their loved ones. Think about when you're in a, you know, self-loathing space where you don't like yourself and you're beating yourself up about everything. How are you towards your children when they do one wrong thing? You immediately lash out at them.
Yes, definitely.
When you're in a space of compassion for yourself, you're much more easily
kinder.
You're much kinder. Mm. You're able to be compassionate with them as well. So all that's what I mean when I say all compassion begins with self-compassion.
That's so true.
Yeah, we can only offer others what we have for ourselves.
Wow. Okay, Zaida, it's so interesting speaking to you, and I have so many more questions. Let's see if we can get this last one in, okay? You spoke in one of on one of your posts, you spoke about your inner sanctuary and how this helped you overcome a harrowing experience. Please elaborate to give us more insight into how you healed yourself.
Okay, so... Yeah, that's an interesting one because it's kind of the difficulties of my life that brought me to where I am. I often say that, I don't know, Allah knows this, but I don't know if I hadn't been through some of the challenges that I've been through, I don't know if I would have the courage to do the kind of work that I do now. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Allah knows this. Mm-hmm. But what happened was there was a lot of stuff going on around that time, around health issues and so on. After I had my second son, I actually had some complications. So I had to have a C-section, and I had a lot of pain around it. 2 weeks after he was born, he was a breastfed baby, and 2 weeks after he was born, I had a two-year-old. My older one was 3 years old, so I had this two-week-old and a two-year-old. I went into major complications, the wound reopened, and I had to have multiple surgeries at that time and be hospitalized. And at the time, it was honestly really touch and go. Every time I was wheeled into theater, I didn't know whether or not I would make it through, whether or not I would come out again. It was a very difficult time. It was very emotionally and physically a very traumatic time. Mm-hmm. And of course, you've got these two young children. I was not allowed to see them during the time I was in the hospital because the risk of infection on my side was so high. I couldn't be exposed to any infection and so on. So what happened at the time, I use this example of how I took myself to a space that allowed me to get through it. What I did at the time was, and I didn't even realize what I was doing, I was just instinctively doing it. Every time the pain got too much, the emotion, the fear, because there was a huge amount of fear. What if you don't make it through? What, you know? And all of it, if I have to say what that time gave me, it gave me an excellent lesson in surrendering control and that I am not in control.
Mm-hmm.
What I did was I would go into my mind and I would retreat and I would bring up memories of times where I felt safe, where I felt secure, where I felt happy. I would constantly play this in my mind and imagine that I was there. So very much building the castle in my ear, in the ears, I really needed that castle. So I would keep retreating into those memories. And now when I look back on it, the science of it shows that I was actually changing my biochemistry and I was creating an ideal environment in which my body could heal. So at the time, my primary concern was physical healing. I just needed to get through that. I was in survival mode. So this served me well. And alhamdulillah, I think it really helped, you know, it's Allah's kalam that I got through, but it really helped me through that process to get through it so I wouldn't be, because sometimes it would feel like that fear and the worry and the grief was just going to overwhelm me, it was going to engulf me, and so retreating in those memories helped a great deal. However, I do want
to say... Sorry, Zaida, I'm going to have to, I think we going for news, we're running out of time. Inshallah, we will continue and we will have you back on the show, inshallah. Jazakallah so much. I can't thank you enough because it's been so insightful, and I think we have so much more questions, but we'll definitely have you again on the show. Jazakallah so much, Zaida.
Thank you so much for having me today. I really enjoyed it. Jazakallah khair.
Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam.
Okay, so we